The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So when it comes to the question of LGBT liberation, we're facing a state of absolute contradiction. On the one side of this contradiction, we have record numbers of people supporting same-sex marriage. 68% of people support same-sex marriage today versus 32% in 1986, which is very significant. The possibility of same-sex marriage finally became a reality with a Supreme Court ruling just 2 years ago. Millennials are more than twice as likely as any other generation to identify as LGBT, and the representation of LGBT people in the media has significantly advanced. Transgender women like Laverne Cox and Caitlyn Jenner have made it to the cover of glossy magazines, and storylines like Transparent revolve around the lives of trans and queer people. On the other side of this contradiction, we have the Trump administration, which has been on a rampage to dismantle any gains that we've won, and inspiring reactionary legislation across the country. On day one of Trump's administration, a report titled Advancing LGBT Workplace Rights was disappeared from the Labor Department's website. Within the first 100 days, the administration also rescinded guidelines directing schools to allow transgender students to use bathrooms and locker rooms corresponding to their gender identity. And let's make no mistake about it, in the context of a society where 82% of transgender youth report feeling unsafe at school, 44% experience physical abuse, and 67% are bullied online by peers, Trump's executive order will have deadly consequences. In fact, LGBT people make up the majority of hate crime victims. Rates of LGBT violence have climbed over the last few years, and people of color and trans people are facing the brunt of these attacks. In 2016, 61% of LGBT hate crimes were people of color. A 2013 report found that 72% of hate crimes against LGBT people were trans women. 90% of those trans women were women of color. 65% of trans people experience violence at work. 51% experience violence, harassment by the police. 78% experience harassment and assault in schools. And since the beginning of 2017, there have been 15 murders of trans women of color. Compared with 14 murders of trans women of color in the entire year of 2014. All of this violence, whether directly or indirectly, is tied to the institutionalized violence of the US state. While the Trump administration is on a rampage to ramp up the oppression of those of us who are most vulnerable, we should understand that LGBT oppression existed before Trump. Before Trump came into power, and its origins lie in the capitalist system. By locating the origins of LGBT oppression and capitalism, we can begin to make sense of the stark contradiction that we have today, both the major advances as well as the continued repression and violence. We can also begin to understand the path out of this contradiction, the end to capitalism itself. So this talk is going to take up a few questions that me and Claire will both take up. Is an end to LGBT oppression possible? If yes, how? Is the oppression of LGBT people something that comes from human nature? If not, where does it come from? As Marxists, we believe that sexual orientation and gender expression are fluid human behaviors shaped by the conditions of human existence and the way society is organized. So in order to talk about the development of the gay identity as well as its subsequent repression, I want to spend some time talking about the development of capitalism and specifically the nuclear family, which is a central function of capitalism. And I'm going to focus mostly on the 19th and 20th century, mostly in the United States. So the family did not always exist. In fact, for most of human history, society has not been organized by the family structure. The family structure developed out of the rise of class society. In 1886, Frederick Engels published The Origins of Family Private Property in the State, which is a text that uses anthropological research on pre-class societies to make an argument, among many others, that although modern human species existed as a species for more than 100,000 years, people only began living in family units in the last several thousand years, when previously egalitarian societies became divided into classes. The family develops as a result of the rise of class society, and it takes on a particular form with the development of capitalism around the end of the 19th century. So the family is no longer an independent unit of production, so you can't rely on your family unit for survival, which is what existed before capital took over, where your family produced your food, your clothes, the soap. You produce everything within your family. Under this new profit system, you know, people aren't producing everything within their family units, but they're selling their labor power for wages. And this doesn't mean that the family disappears, but it does take on a new function under capitalism. It becomes a place where labor power is reproduced. In order to sell your labor for a wage, you need to be living. You need to eat, sleep, stay healthy, stay clean, all the things that keep us ready for our bosses to exploit us. And what develops with this new system is a social institution, the nuclear family, which is responsible for doing all this labor. The family develops into a cheap way of raising the next generation of workers, work that is mostly done by women. And because this institution is so dependent on the unpaid labor of women, it is developed and maintained by an ideology that emphasizes heterosexuality and stigmatizes other forms of sexuality. Although sexual acts between same-sex partners and gender fluidity are as old or older than humanity itself, distinct LGBT and queer identities are a recent human phenomenon based on the specific historical conditions of capitalism. So this new system of wage labor helps crystallize the nuclear family as a social institution, which is used to regulate gender and sexuality. But it also opens up the social space for the gay identity to emerge, with a major growth in cities where people could find ways for the first time to link up outside of the traditional family setting. In Sexuality and Socialism, written by Sherry Wolfe, who is in this room, she writes, "It was capitalism, in fact, that gave rise to modern individuality and the conditions for people to have intimate lives based on personal desire, a historic break from the power of the feudal church and the community that once arranged marriages. Under capitalism, a person's labor is converted into individually owned commodity that is bought and sold on the market. Individuals are thrust into competition with each other for work, housing, education, etc., and individual citizens of states are counted in a census and registered to vote, or if they have the means, own property. All of these features of capitalist society establish individuality in ways unthinkable under earlier systems like feudalism, creating the potential for a flourishing of sexual autonomy as well." So this marks the beginning of the gay identity, which cuts across gender, race, social status, new language and terminology emerges. The word homosexuality becomes a thing in 1886. But because same-sex relationships threaten the system that capitalists rely on for unpaid labor to reproduce the next generation of workers, they have used many means to regulate and control our sexuality and gender, as well as our reproduction, but that's another talk. The level of social acceptance of LGBT people that exists today would be shocking to past generations who are forced to live in secrecy in fear of losing their jobs, their home, even their lives. And this is again from Sherry's book. Okay. In 1953, Eisenhower signed an executive order that established sexual perversion as grounds for being fired from government jobs. Sex between consulting adults of the same sex, even in a private home, could be punished by up to life in prison, confinement in a mental institution, or even castration. And the torturous practices, and that's end quote, and the torturous practices supported by our current administration as well. You know, Mike Pence is well known as a supporter of conversion therapy. And this was something that, you know, it still exists today. 1 in 3 LGBT people actually deal with some sort of conversion therapy, which is insane. But yeah, this was a common practice during this time. And along with medical experiments, so Sherry writes about this hospital in California, which was known as the Chow for queers, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, in gay circles, for its horrific practices, including waterboarding. And for those who don't know what the Chow is, it's the name of a Nazi concentration camp. LGBT oppression, like all oppression under capitalism, is also used as a way to divide and conquer the ruling class. Capitalism cannot survive without oppression. The working class makes up the majority and has the social power to bring the system to a halt. We are many, they are few, yet as long as we remain divided, we're limited in our ability to fight back and win. And this is why the capitalist class divides us up in a number of ways, by race, sex, nationality, sexual preference, language, disability, etc. Not only are we weakened by our ability to come together and fight our real enemies, but it also affects our immediate conditions. If capitalists are able to justify the low wages of one oppressed group, all of our wages are brought down. This is why socialists are constantly trying to show how exploitation and oppression are interconnected and condition each other, and how the solution to one cannot be separated from the solution to the other. With repression, inevitably comes resistance, and that is exactly what, you know, develops in the beginning of the 20th century. While there are various ways people resisted against capitalism's repressive control over gender and sexuality in the early 20th century, it wasn't really until the 1950s and that political organization emerges to defend LGBT people. So I want to just spend some time talking about that history, as well as the resistance that develops in the 1960s, which marked a historic advancement for LGBT people. So one of the first organized groups to take up LGBT oppression is the Mattachine Society, which was founded by former Communist Party member Harry Hay. Harry Hay, I didn't know much about until doing this talk. He's really interesting. He was introduced to Marxism as a teenager he spent his summers on a farm, his cousin's farm, and like met IWW members, where he was introduced to Marxism through their pamphlets. He later became involved in labor organizing and the Communist Party. He was actually part of the 1934 San Francisco General Strike, an event that he said changed his life forever. And while he witnessed the development of a political backlash to the movements of the 1930s, he had a new sense of urgency around the idea that gays should get organized to defend themselves from upcoming attacks, which Hay could see coming through witnessing things like the passing of the Smith Act. During this time, the Communist Party in the United States adopted the hostility to homosexuality led by the Soviet Union under Stalin. The CP denounced homosexuality as a bourgeois deviation. He was pushed out of the CP for his sexuality, but that didn't stop him from organizing. It took Harry a couple of years to find that one person he needed to help create an organization. And I was watching this video where he's just talking about their first action together with like going to this gay beach and trying to get signatures for a petition around the Korean War. And this kind of launches the beginning of what would turn into the Mattachine Society, which is founded in 1950 in Southern California. And its mission was to unify, educate, and lead a movement for LGBT equality. The Mattachine Society became a space for both theory and organizing actions and campaigns. In 1966, the society decided to take inspiration from the civil rights sit-ins that integrated so many lunch counters and restaurants and stage a sip-in, where they would go to a tavern, declare they were gay, order a drink, and then waited to be served or turn away, and then sue them. This action was somewhat of a precursor to Stonewall. The Daughters of Bilitis formed shortly after in 1955 as a similar organization, but focused on lesbian issues. And although these organizations laid an important foundation for the future development of the struggle for LGBT liberation, their politics were mixed and tended to focus on the aim of winning acceptance in society. So there's stories of like people had to wear the right thing on pickets and not look too crazy to prove to the world that they weren't sick people, they weren't crazy. So this is some progress. There's new organizations that are developing, but the repression remains very strong. Gay bars, which were seen as one of the only safe spaces for LGBT people at this time, were regularly targeted by the police. Gay dancing, kissing, and so-called cross-dressing were considered illegal. They were considered disorderly conduct. And LGBT people faced massive raids, arrests, and violence from the police, which really sets the backdrop of the birth of gay power. The Stonewall Revolt. The Stonewall Revolt advanced the LGBT movement like nothing before it. And such an incredible piece of history. So what happened is, I mean, so these raids are regular, but there's one particular night, it's in June 1969, where the police come in to Stonewall, one of the most popular gay bars in New York City, and they demand everyone line up, take out your IDs, more aggressive than usual. And the people in that bar don't take it that night. They decide that they're gonna fight back. And so the people that night started throwing glasses, fists, high-heeled shoes, and fought back against this police violence. And in a matter of hours, this riot grew to 2,000 people as word spread. And community members joined in. The rebellion continued throughout the next week with organized leftists and the LGBT community joining in. And this uprising was multiracial, it was diverse, it reflected a broad spectrum of the LGBT community. Many eyewitnesses commented specifically on the important role that night by the most marginalized sections of the community, street kids, trans women, and queer youth of color. 2 weeks later, after this rebellion, activists called for an open organizing meeting that really, for the first time, unapologetically takes up LGBT liberation. So the flyer that they had for this open organizing meeting, it had gay power on it, no one is free until everyone is free, homosexual liberation meeting. And this meeting drew out 40 people, and it marked the beginning of a new historical era for the LGBT movement. It was here that activists first chose the name the Gay Liberation Front, modeled on Vietnam's National Liberation Front, the guerrilla communist movement fighting against the United States. Unlike the respectability politics of the organizations of the 50s and early 60s that advocated gays to win acceptance in heterosexual society through assimilation, the Gay Liberation Front's politics were fundamentally shaped by the radical politics of the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and the Black Power struggles of that time. So I just want to read a bit from one of their statements in a pamphlet. This is written by the Chicago chapter. Because of the rampant oppression we see of Black, third world people, women, workers, in addition to our own, because of the corrupt values, because of the injustices, we no longer want to make it in America. Our particular struggle is for sexual self-determination, the abolition of sex role stereotypes, and the human right to use of one's body without interference from the legal and social institutions of the state. Many of us have understood that our struggle cannot succeed without a fundamental change in society, which will put the source of power, means of production, in the hands of the people who at the present have nothing. But as our struggle grows, it will be made clear by the changing objective conditions that our liberation is inextricably bound to the liberation of all oppressed people. So that's a really huge political advancement from some of these other organizations, and it totally has to do with the radical political upsurge during this time. The Gay Liberation Front likewise shaped the politics of other liberation struggles. A letter from Huey to the Revolutionary Brothers and Sisters about the women's liberation movement, about the women's liberation and gay liberation movements, argued against homophobia within the Black Panther Party, saying homosexuals are not given freedom and liberty by anyone in society. The Gay Liberation Front organized protests and direct actions to pressure politicians to support gay rights, establish community service programs to provide food and social services to LGBT street youth, and they organized political education as well. One of their first study groups was actually on Frederick Engels' Origins of the Family and Private Property in the State. And from the beginning, members debated whether the group should focus exclusively on gay issues or connect itself with other struggles on the left, which led to a split, with some activists leaving to establish a single-issue organization called the Gay Activists Alliance, which defined itself as a group exclusively devoted to the liberation of homosexuals and avoids involvement in any program of action not obviously relevant to homosexuals. One other significant accomplishment of the gay liberation movement of this time was the protest, which was organized by the Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Activist Alliance together, against the American Psychiatric Association's designation of homosexuality as a mental illness, which is a huge accomplishment. The Gay Liberation Front wasn't able to win gay liberation for reasons that Claire will get into, but activists did change the course of history, transform social conditions for LGBT people, and gave birth to a modern LGBT movement. And in doing so, they provided future generations of radicals and revolutionaries with critical lessons for the challenges that we face today. So now I'm gonna hand it over to Claire.
So it's instructive to consider the victories of the Gay Liberation Front within the constellation of mass movements of the 60s and 70s. Militant labor struggles curtailed production speed-ups and won higher wages. The civil rights and Black Power struggles forced the Johnson and Nixon administrations to institute sweeping anti-discrimination and anti-poverty programs. In 1973, the women's rights movement won the right not only to abortion, but federally funded abortion for working and poor women. But while their victories were significant, these movements fell short of carrying out a social revolution, of uprooting capitalism, as Amanda described, the origin of all oppression and exploitation in a society. And as long as capitalism stays intact, any gains made by our side stay tenuous. The 1974 recession, was the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression. After the long post-war boom, the 24 richest countries saw their growth rates fall from 5% to 0%. If capitalism was to get back on its feet, it would do so only through an employer offensive to cripple labor unions, drive down wages, and intensify work, along with a gradual but relentless dethreading of the social safety net in a project that came to be known as neoliberalism. As Sherry Wolf argues in Sexuality and Socialism, the employer's offensive could not succeed in its aims without an ideological assault on the social movements that had shifted the political climate so far to the left in that era. So how's, somebody had to take care of this, right? And make that shift happen. So a consortium of Christian fundamentalists, ultra-white right-wing politicians, and big business led the charge in shifting this political terrain to the right. Coined the new right, the likes of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, or the faces of well-funded PR campaigns to promote legislation attacking every single gain just described. So abandoning the streets in the face of attacks, much of what remained of the left took shelter inside the Democratic Party. The gay liberation movement was no exception. Rather than salvation, however, the Dems have mostly delivered disappointment to its LGBT base. The list of Democratic betrayals are long, but I think probably most illustrative was Bill Clinton's turn from a gay rights campaign platform in 1992 to then turning around and instituting Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 1994 and the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996. So real friend he was. With few feet in the streets and no real friends in the Democrats, the results were devastating. The 1976 Hyde Amendment gutted working class and poor women's access to abortion. Reagan, Bush, and Clinton propped up racist tropes like the welfare queen and the super predator to gut welfare on the one hand and institute mass incarceration on the other. Through relentless vitriol and brutal negligence, Reagan's administration and total assholes like Senator Jesse Helms and the new right painted AIDS as a gay crisis, absolving the government of any responsibility to fight the epidemic. Policies restricted CDC funding for AIDS prevention, barred US entry to those who were infected, and a bunch of other really terrible stuff. These policies set a trajectory of millions of deaths and rolled back a decade struggle for LGBT rights that won the declassification of homosexuality as a disease. The AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, which there's also going to be a talk, which I'm sure is gonna be awesome, that Sherry's giving later. So I'm just gonna give you a little taste right now. Really carried the torch of LGBT struggle through the dark ages of the 80s and 90s and proved that even in the most reactionary times, people will fight back against their oppression. Through direct action tactics and independent scientific research teams, ACT UP activists won early drug trials, greater transparency, and acceleration in the pace of AIDS research and experimental treatments, and a shift in public opinion towards acceptance of those with AIDS. Some of ACT UP's most successful actions, those targeting the Catholic Church's anti-safe sex message and Wall Street AIDS drug profiteering, were built broadly and drew out thousands of gay and straight people to target the centers of power. So ACT UP, though, had some significant shortcomings that led to internal quarrel within the movement and isolation from allies. But before I describe these shortcomings further, I want to kind of provide a context. So many gay activists of the 60s and 70s had at that time thought that working class struggle to overthrow the whole system of oppression was both possible and necessary for achieving full sexual liberation. The rapid decline of labor union strength and at least the appearance of US deindustrialization shored up the idea that the working class no longer had power. Nominally socialist countries like Russia and China failed to usher in liberation. And this meant for many, as Sherry puts it, that Marxist politics and the strategy of collective struggle were at best anachronisms and at worst, fatally flawed. So seeking a way out of Marxism, former activists turned academics developed postmodernism. So while the fundamental purpose of the Marxist method is understanding the world in order to change it, postmodernism really adheres to one truth, and that is that nothing is knowable, and that any unifying theory like Marxism is an imposition of knowledge from above. Also, rather than power being a matter of class, and rather than seeing oppression as rooted in class relations, postmodernists see power as manifested in identity relations and of dominant identities wielding power to suppress subordinate identities. That's kind of there's a lot more to say about postmodernism. That's me trying to shove it all in a paragraph. If revolution was impossible and the working class as a social force was no longer relevant, what should be fought for and who should fight for it? Postmodernists theorize that siloed identity groups could and should replace the working class as the agent of change. Experiencing an impression determines one's ability and desire to struggle, and those who seen as lacking that experience are at best useless and at worst play a role in perpetuating that oppression. So autonomy and separation as opposed to unity and action. So this is kind of the birth of identity politics. Identity politics dominated much of the political life of ACT UP. The organization was guided by a belief that only those deemed as at risk of contracting HIV/AIDS had a stake in fighting against the disease, and largely everyone else, regardless of class, race, and gender, did not. And at that time, it was seen as gay men being those who were at risk. With some important exceptions mentioned earlier, rather than building collective mass resistance with non-infected allies to fight the centers of power, activists favored things called zap actions, so these small group actions that led kiss-ins at malls and loogie-hawking at churchgoers with the aim to shock and shame individuals. And I think Sherry puts it really well that it was really an expression of anger but didn't really kind of show a way forward. Sherry also argues, I think this is one of my favorite points in her book, that class politics could have kept the ACT UP flame alive and could have won far greater victories by building coalition with Black and Latino communities, which only a decade later would become the growing face of the HIV/AIDS crisis, and waging a single-payer healthcare movement for AIDS treatment, free abortion, and access to healthcare needs for the working and poor on demand. The pessimism that stultified the LGBT movements of the 80s and 90s was disrupted, luckily, thankfully, by an upsurge of LGBT struggle beginning in the 2000s for marriage equality. The struggle for marriage equality was born out of the contradictions described by Amanda earlier. So growing public support, more and more people coming out of the closet, alongside entrenched institutionalized homophobia. Anti-sodomy laws were still on the books back in 2003. So, and actually some places they still are, which is just, okay. Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage, and this was also the beginning of sparking protests across the country for marriage equality. But it was the passage of California Proposition 8 in 2008, which reversed the California Supreme Court legalization of same-sex marriage earlier that year, that galvanized a movement for federal marriage equality. Thousands fled into the streets, joining demonstrations organized by the No on Prop 8 campaign. It's a little confusing. No on Prop 8, they wanted to keep gay marriage, and Yes on Prop 8 wanted to reverse the repeal, just to kind of, thousands fled into the streets, joining the protests organized by No on Prop 8. Spontaneous, unplanned breakaway marches were led by outraged youth, and dozens were arrested for civil disobedience across California. In the weeks following, independent, bottom-up, grassroots groups were formed. The new upsurge was called Stonewall 2.0, and I think that actually, it's such a great title because you think about like the way in which both movements kind of were this sort of this quantitative changes happening and then this qualitative shift that led to these mass movements. So the new upsurge of Stonewall 2.0 really caught the gay rights establishment, like the HRC, totally flat-footed. From 2009 to 2011, large demonstrations erupted in cities across the country, protests and occupations at county clerk's offices, regular demonstrations in the hundreds and even thousands for marriage equality, funding for homeless youth, and against LGBT workplace discrimination. Marriage equality organizations also built solidarity with other movements and with labor. So they endorsed protests in support of and participated in protests in support of the 2009 Republic Windows and Doors factory occupation, and participated in solidarity work for the Hyatt Hertz boycott campaign to support housekeepers and other Hyatt workers for better working conditions. In 2010, these groups organized and led the National Equality March, where some 250,000 people marched across the country demanding the end to Don't Ask, Don't Tell and DOMA, calling for federal protections in employment and housing and full equality for trans people, and of course, marriage equality. Democrats naysayed every step of the way. Hope and Change President Barack Obama opposed gay marriage until 2012. Barney Frank, the only openly gay senator, famously said, now is not the time, referring to the Marriage Equality March, that the only thing you will be putting pressure on is the grass. I think it's a testament to the independence of these movements that they still carried forward, and so much was happening despite the kind of pushback that they were getting from the establishment. Grassroots organizations began to lose momentum by 2011, and the battles over marriage equality were fought in the courts over the next 4 years. But there's no doubt what actually won marriage equality. We see how the entrenched homophobia in our society, nothing will move that unless there's a social movement to move that. And I think that's what we saw with marriage equality. So, yes, it was won out in the courts, but it was because the fight was carried out beforehand. So activists faced not only the snark and naysaying of Democrats and the tunnel vision of Gay Inc., as the gay rights establishment came to be known, but also criticism from some voices on the left who claimed that the fight for marriage equality was at best useless and at worst actual violence towards people, queer people, facing a multitude of intersecting oppression. So in his article, Rainbows and Weddings, the Neoliberal and Imperialist Politics of LGBT Rights, Melab Jamil argued, marriage equality is the successful attempt to de-radicalize the queer who has far more radical demands like abolition of the prison industrial complex, state hegemony, capitalism, racism, and imperialism. Prioritization of such legislation by the state tells the queer subject that all he needs is the ability to marry like heterosexual people and have children to be happy. The homonormative queers, white suburban dads with their biracial adopted children, become the poster boys of the nationalist project. So I think that there are a lot of things that are really wrong about this. And actually, Keegan O'Brien also first weighed in on a lot of these things quite articulately in a Jacobin piece in 2015. So the first issue is this argument gives all the credit to politicians, right? And it ignores the fact that the grassroots struggle for marriage equality was actually forged by a multiracial working class struggle. And it was actually in opposition to the establishment. I think the second being that this idea that only cis, white, rich, normative, gay men benefit from the demand of marriage equality, I think this also totally ignores the material gains working class queer people ushered in through marriage equality. I mean, think about it, like tax benefits, when that tax return is the one thing that can stave off like personal financial ruin. When you think about joint custody as working class families face increasing precarity and hospital visitation rates in a time when working class people are getting sicker and sicker, when it comes to gay marriage, I think actually working class people have the most to win. So I think finally, the ultra-left position claims that the fighting for civil rights actually inoculates those who, as a condition of their identity, would otherwise adhere to a fight for a radical vision. Therefore, we must reject reforms that legitimate the system and fight for revolution instead. I mean, I think it's true, and I think I actually don't think many people who are actually part of the marriage equality struggle would say that marriage equality, winning marriage equality wins everything, right? It's true that, you know, winning gay marriage doesn't actually change the structure of capitalist society. And capitalism is flexible, right? I mean, as long as, you know, we're not doing anything to attack the bottom line of capitalism, the profit motive, and as long as it isn't disruptive, its managers, the state, will allow all kinds of configurations of families. As long as the system stays intact, every single reform we win too can be taken away. So we as socialists say that full sexual liberation is bound up in the tearing down of the system through total social transformation and revolution. But as revolutionary socialists, we don't counterpose the fight for reforms and the fight for revolution. We see the two as inextricably linked. So the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky explained this relationship succinctly, urging revolutionaries not only to struggle for reforms, but to take the initiative in building broad movements to fight for them. Quote, because the greater is the mass drawn into the movement, the higher its self-confidence rises, all the more self-confident will that mass movement be, and all the more resolutely will it be capable of marching forward, however modest may be the initial slogans of struggle. So we participate in struggles for LGBT reform not by following the dictates of Gay Inc. Rather, we aim to win leadership in these struggles. This allows our ideas and the ideas of reformists to be measured against each other in practice. This way, we fight for a better life today, as well as win more and more people over to the project of social revolution. So I think we can actually even get a little taste of what this social revolution could look like, what sexual liberation could look like, by taking a look at the experience in the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution in October 1917 was a workers' revolution in which the masses organized by workers, soldiers, and peasants' councils rose up to overthrow the bourgeois government. The revolution led to the immediate transfer of the economy into the hands of workers. An immediate and unprecedented social transformation followed, opening up a level of social liberty that wouldn't be matched in any other society for decades to come. The Soviets abolished the old bourgeois penal codes, granting women the right to divorce without legal justification, legalizing abortion, and legalizing homosexuality, treating sex as a purely private matter. So this was a full 90 years before the US Supreme Court finally struck down anti-sodomy laws. So crucially for Russian revolutionaries, sexual liberation, like every other Soviet project, was not just a matter of changing laws. It required a material transformation of society, one dependent upon mass participation in democratic debate and the application and assessment of new forms of social organization. So the Bolshevik Alexander Kollontai described sexual politics in Soviet Russia this way, the problems of sex occupy such a central place in life and society. when the question of relationships between the sexes has been like a conjurer attracting the attentions of millions of troubled people, when sexual dramas have served as such a never-ending source of inspiration for every sort of art. So, thanks. Okay, I'll speed it up here. So yeah, so things like, even the debate that was going on at that time kind of presaged the one that we have today, where it's like, why are we even trying to reform marriage in our society? Why don't we just get rid of it, right? And a lot of the leading Bolsheviks said, well, we can't just decree our way out of the institution of marriage. We actually have to build a society where the institution of marriage can wither away. So socializing of childcare and kitchens and modernizing psychiatry and sexual medicine were all key to actually altering the material conditions that upheld and reproduced patriarchal and sexual repression. So there were psychiatrists who were, you know, going against the mainstream and were working with their patients to help them embrace their sexuality at that time. People were performing sex change operations. These are things that are like light years ahead of anywhere else in the world. So the factors limiting full sexual emancipation were the material constraints imposed on the revolution itself, right? Because if they hadn't been limited, we'd have sexual liberation right now. So what had actually kept full sexual emancipation from happening was in revolutionary Russia was war, famine, and general scarcity. The generalized want that followed the civil war in Russia is what eventually doomed the revolution, wiping out the working class foundation for a socialist society, setting the stage for Stalin's counter-revolution. And so Stalin's bureaucracy created a society based on state capitalism in military and industrial competition with other imperialist forces, which required the need for higher birth rates. Not only was abortion outlawed, but women were given medals for prolific procreation. And homosexuality was recriminalized and attacked as a bourgeois deviation and even associated with Nazism in Stalinist propaganda. So in describing the challenges of reaching the full vision of women's liberation, Trotsky argued, you cannot abolish the family, you have to replace it. The actual liberation of women is unrealizable on the basis of generalized want. The same can be said of sexual liberation, and the same can be said of the aspirations of the Gay Liberation Front, of ACT UP, and of the LGBT struggles today, 100 years after the Russian Revolution, throughout the world. Economic and social crisis caused by decades of austerity since the 70s, punctuated by the 2008 global recession, has delegitimized the global neoliberal political center and caused an ever-widening political polarization. People are hungry for a politics that will answer the question of economic justice. The right's answer are gaining a hearing in the absence of mass movements, militant class struggle, and strong socialist politics and organization that can point the way forward. So Trump in the US, Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, Ramzan Kadyrov in Chechnya, among others, embody a politics that explains our despair by scapegoating LGBT people, as well as people of color, immigrants, Muslims, and women, and the poor. But as the right emboldens, the breadth and depth of left politics are growing too. Even under conditions of brutal state repression, Chechen activists have been organizing against Kadyrov's gay concentration camps. In the US, people are connecting the dots between the LGBT oppression and state-sponsored racist violence and Islamophobia. In pride parades across the country, activists are marching in no pride for cops contingents and carrying no to homophobia, no to Islamophobia, and no to racist war banners. These shifts are not taking place because a few armchair radicals finally gained a hearing. It's because of the last 4 years of Black Lives Matter movement against racist state violence, Occupy and the growing resurgence of class politics, and a growing movement against the Muslim ban, the border wall, and mass deportations. While the contradictions of capitalism make struggle inevitable, revolution is not. People need to be one not just to fight against right-wing attacks, but also to the project of organizing for social transformation. And they will not be one to this project simply because revolutionary ideas are articulated to them. They reach those conclusions through witnessing and participating in struggle, however partial the initial demands, struggling alongside revolutionaries who make the arguments that connect the dots between reform and revolution. This, comrades, is the only way to ensure that fully automated luxury space, gay space communism is not just a meme, but a reality.
All right.
I'll just take up a couple things and I'll be really brief. On the point that we would have I think, Alex, you're totally right. You know, marriage equality wasn't given to us. We had to fight for it. We had to take it. I think also, too, capitalism never wanted to give it to us. Capitalism would be very happy to still have to take back that gain because of the way in which inequality between heterosexual people and gay people actually divides the working class, creates the uneven consciousness that makes class struggle really, really hard. And this is one of the ways in which that actually breaks down. I think that that's absolutely critical to remember that they would profit much more off of us never having won it in the first place. And I think too, just to say, like, we have to realize, like, how do ideas change, right? Like, ideas don't change unless people are actually out in the streets. Ideas don't change unless people are actually organizing and are participating, democratic debates, participating in the struggle, thinking things through, and then actually seeing, like, the betrayals of the mainstream gay rights organizations, and seeing actually that we actually need to embrace a broader set of liberatory politics. And so I think that the ideas of, like, well, you know, gay marriage is just like it's just for the rich and bourgeois, and that, like, what we need to do is just really stay siloed in our own little groups and fight for the smallest of the smallest kinds of demands, fight for our survival, you know? I think that these are really the politics of defeat. These are the politics of postmodernism that I think that, like, we will stay stultified, we will stay stuck in the exact same place. What we need is class struggle. Is that my time?
You got a minute.
Damn, I felt like I was talking a long time. And I just want to say, I think that's it. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming.
Okay, that was a great discussion. I want to actually just talk about my personal life for a minute. I come from a working class family. My mother is a lesbian. My mother didn't come out until she was about 38. And today she's now married to a woman. And going through doing this talk was actually the first time that I really learned a lot of this theory and history. And it was so remarkable to me to just see how far we have come and to think about all those years that my mother felt like she couldn't talk about her sexuality, and how the struggles, the grassroots struggles, have moved us forward in so many ways and totally transformed the way that, I mean, even just this last Pride, I went to Providence Pride with my mother and her wife, and two of my aunts joined us, and it was just like an experience I could never imagine even like 6 years ago. People are seen as, people are able to confidently come out with their sexual identities in a way that didn't exist before Stonewall, before the struggle for gay marriage, which, you know, that actually contributed tremendously to the changing of ideas. And another thing that struck me in just thinking about all this talk and all these ideas is just how the way that capitalism is so obsessed with repressing and regulating our bodies, our sexuality, our gender, and how much that affects our daily lives, and for them it's for, you know, another book, and how disgusting that is. And it's so important that we actually locate the source of our own liberation, which we talk about a lot in the ISO, and we will this weekend, which is the working class. And so any struggle that's waged by our side is a huge step forward, and we want to continue to build on that and build on that, so that we can tear the system apart, so we aren't constantly being policed for, you know, our gender, sexuality. And I also just, yeah, that's it really. But thank you so much.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.